CB Shocking Jazz.
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet. I mean, clap your heads.
Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
CRN Studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is Racing Through History.
I was getting all the buttons pushed and forgot the intro. Welcome to the Goat Rodeo. My name is Jeff Gilder, and I'm just pushing the buttons and stuff. Somebody else is going to do all the talking tonight because we got Bill Hennessy in the studio with us. Say hello, Bill.
What I want to do is say thanks for giving me the invitation to coming up here. Jack Walker and I have known each other forever and forever and forever, and Jack actually went with me to my first driver school in SCCA back in 1971 down at Road Atlanta, and I'm still getting to ride around these days. But Jack was always a keen supporter and always somebody who liked racing a lot, and we even ventured down to Daytona in the mid-60s, took the weekend off from WTGR at that time, and met down there and used to go by WROD in Daytona, which used to be in the Ocean Plaza Hotel on the oceanfront. And that's when, of course, they had the Pure Firebird traffic reports on WROD to get you in and out of the racetrack, brought to you by the Embry-Riddle Air Academy. Just a couple of recollections there for anybody that should remember back to the mid-60s.
You can tell we're going to have to shut him up sometime.
There's a lot of W's in
there. Oh, yeah.
But I love the way these radio guys, these broadcast guys, the real ones, speak. They say W.
Yeah,
W.
It's not W.
It's W.
Remember that.
W.
Tiger. It was Tiger Radio.
That's right.
1520, wasn't that it?
Mm-hmm. Clear channel. Same frequency that KBW in Buffalo was on, and so it couldn't be on at night.
Cool
stuff.
Of course, you know, people that don't know Bill may know that he's been a motorsports broadcaster for years, worked on WTBS, ESPN, what else, Bill?
USA.
USA.
Fox Sports.
Fox, bunch of them.
TNN.
And he's a race car driver. He's finished fifth, I think, at Daytona in the Goodies Dash Series in 88, 89?
That was 88.
88.
10th in 87.
Yeah.
8th in 92. 8th again. And DNF'd with the fastest car I ever had down there. And ran again in the top 10 back in 97. I think I ran 8th again or 7th. It was lots of fun. I don't think a lot of folks ever have the opportunity to go and drive at a place like Daytona. And now it's almost impossible to get there, no matter what division you're in, to run at Daytona. I used to like to say that Daytona, during speed weeks, basically you had 200 drivers down there, and you had 160 that actually got to take a green flag. But that's of 29,000 guys that race every weekend, that only 160 get a green flag at least one time at Daytona. And I think everybody would be remiss in the fact that they know the Super Speedway, but they've forgotten the Beach Road course.
Yep. Well, you know, every year before the Daytona 500, the week before, the vintage cars do the parade on the beach, and Bobby and Hugh and I have been down there several times.
And W.C. Bell goes
down
there.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Yep.
So we always have a good time down there. I hope you can make it down one year for that.
Well, I think that one of the things that a lot of people don't realize, and I'd like to say it today, and hopefully somebody is listening that can possibly do something about this. Who is the biggest selling author on the Grand Strand of Horry County? Think about it.
I would guess Greg Fielding.
Greg Fielding.
Yep.
That would be correct, because Greg Fielding has sold more books than anyone other than Mickey Spillane, I would say.
And, of course, Mickey Spillane drove a race car at Coastal Speedway.
Right, and he also had a very special car that was given to him by John Wayne that basically deteriorated under his carport. It was a Jaguar XK that he got in, like, 1953, 1954, and sat under the portico of his house down there and eventually saw a lot of rust on it. As we talk about cars.
Yeah, we like to do that here.
That's cool. Cool stuff. Go ahead, Bobby. Spit it out.
Bobby's soaking it up, thinking about something. Yeah. How did Greg Fielding come to live in the Myrtle Beach area?
Yeah,
what
Greg
is the story
was not
on
from
that? Yeah, he, I know that.
Maryland.
Maryland.
So how did that all come
His
about?
His dad was the guy that developed the Waterway Hills Golf Course, and he constructed it, and he was the initial innovator down there. They had lived in Charlotte for a while, my understanding. And then Greg came down here, and everybody's got to remember. I'll tell you a Greg Fielding story if you're interested. Greg was the tram operator for the Skyway. And he
at Waterway Hills.
At
that
Water,
was, that
at
was
Waterway
in the 70s
Hills.
When
that's
it
right.
Came
that
online.
Was in the 70s.
That's fairly
and
recent.
He started writing racing columns for many of the papers that are no longer around. In doing so, he started traveling around the Lakeview, Hartsville, Darlington at that time. Dublin had started running in many of the dirt tracks. And he wrote articles and basically gave race results. And he had a keen interest in it. 1979, I met him at Myrtle Beach Speedway where I was the announcer. And that was one of those years that we were racing dirt. And he invited me to go to Hartsville, Darlington. And Joe Lavender let me be the announcer over there. In 1981, I was running Performance Racing Network and decided that we needed a statistician. And Ken Squire was going to join the broadcast that year after we had had Harold Johnson of WSOC be the anchor man. And I told Squire, I said, this guy really keeps up with racing. He knows everybody at the short track level who's on their way up. And Squire goes, Bill, I've got to use someone else. I've got to get somebody who's been in here some period of time. And I go, well, that's fine. But I said, you're really missing out on the best guy. Well, the other guy said he had a commitment on Friday afternoon and wasn't going to be able to do it. So Greg came in the booth, and Greg had the 3x5 file cards, handing them to Squire, making him sound like $1 million. Sam Ard, I don't know him. That's what he said.
Ken Squire said that.
That because he didn't. He only knew he was in the 00 car, the country cured ham car. And Fielding, of course, said he's from Scranton, South Carolina. He's recently lived in Dillon. He moved up to Sanford, North Carolina to be where the country cured hams are made. And gave Squire all this information. At the end of the broadcast, this was October of 81, he goes, what are you doing during the Daytona 500? And Fielding said, really, I probably might go to Daytona. And he was always reluctant. So what happened was Squire hired him to be the statistician for the Daytona 500 CBS broadcast. And that was his first big deal. The next one was he had the opportunity to work for Paul Page after I'd taken him to some IndyCar races when I was doing the IndyCar radio network for 3 years for Roger Penske. And in doing so, he met Page, and Page asked him, could he come to the Indy 500? And this was about 85. And Squire said, you go up there, you can't come back and work for me. And, hey, man, you're losing the best guy in the business. Because I honestly believe that. So he went because he wanted to see the Indy cars run. He had historical perspective on the Indy cars like he did with the stock cars. Mm-hmm. So he got to work the Indy 500 several years. Greg fell into something. He had done all the documentation on all the races historically since the beginning. He had gone to each town that had hosted a Grand National race, now Cup, at that time, and tried to get a complete rundown and the story that was written in the newspapers. As he was compiling this, there was another upstate guy that worked for the Spartanburg Herald Tribune named Gene Granger, and Gene was contracted to write a documented history of NASCAR by R.J. Reynolds, and he never finished it. So Fielding said, I've been working on that, and they hired him, and then he had access to all the NASCAR archives. And in doing so, hits when he wrote the first basic 10 years of stock car racing. And he was kind enough in the first three editions to acknowledge me as helping him along the way, because we used to ride to the races on Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoons on many occasions. And he always talked about writing a book, but I always thought it would be like racing under the full moon. But instead, he documented everything, and look how many different books he's contributed to now, and that's why you have a documented history of NASCAR's upper divisions. But Greg lives down in Surfside. Unfortunately, right. He had a stroke several years ago, and he doesn't get out in public and do much, and I really miss talking to him. I really miss seeing him, because he was great at it.
Yeah.
But if you ever walk through the pit area with him, and a security guard saw him, he was going to stop fielding and ask him for his credential. He didn't look like he belonged there. He always had a leather hat on with a cross on it. And who was his hero? Jan Opperman.
Greg, he's made it down to the vintage thing at Living Legends.
Yeah, he likes to go down there every year. Yeah, he helped get that started.
Yeah, we see him down there. So,
but there are a lot of stories out there, I think, that people don't realize, especially of people that lived in our area that have gone on to do quite well at it. I'd like to say the University of South Carolina is the home of the NASCAR Mafia, because you got to remember that in the late 50s, there were guys going and playing for the University of South Carolina and the Gamecocks that later became executives within NASCAR, one of those being Jim Hunter, who was an end from North Charleston, South Carolina, Humpy Wheeler, who was the son of the football coach up at Belmont Abbey. And then you had Jim Duncan, who later became an executive with Alcoa Aluminum and later was a marketing and sales manager at Charlotte Motor Speedway. You had Joe Whitlock from over at Kingstree, South Carolina, who was a student sports information director. You had Bob Talbert, who was involved in motorsports and wrote a column. And the heroes that I had when I was a kid were the guys that wrote the weekly and daily columns for the newspapers. The Charlotte Observer at that time was George Cunningham. And you had Bob Myers, who wrote for the Charlotte News. But prior to him was a guy that really was instrumental in professional sports in Charlotte. And he was the PR guy for Dodge and All-American Racers. He wrote the marketing plan that was accepted by the NBA and the NFL, and got the Bobcats and the Panthers to Charlotte. One of the greatest sports writers as far as motorsports was concerned, but you got to remember, when he was writing was back in the mid-60s.
Wow.
And all of those guys eventually had an influence on NASCAR. NASCAR was a product of guys that really knew the subject matter.
Well,
they weren't professional marketers.
They loved
fans.
It. The guys I'm talking about used to go out, and they were fans. They stood on the back of pickup trucks at the old Columbia Speedway, and they learned the sport at that level. An interesting fact, and I brought this up to Richard Petty the other day, and this is a good little story you may enjoy. If you're a teacher, you will really enjoy this story. Whitlock went through the archives when they were throwing things away at Daytona and cleaning out their files, and he got Richard Petty's very first NASCAR driver's application. Now, what do you think Richard Petty put down for hobby? It's kind of a question there, right? He wrote down his hobby was handwriting.
Handwriting.
Okay. I brought this to his attention the other day when we were talking to Thad Moffitt, his grandson, who's going to race out here in the Myrtle Beach 400 and also try to race this weekend. And Thad said, my granddad's been trying to teach me how to write my name. I asked him how he did that. So he said, Granddad, help me start writing and everything. Well, Rebecca, Richard's daughter, Thad's mother, says, a Christmas ago, Richard went back and found his documentation of when he was learning how to write cursive in school. And he had the notebook, and he had the book he learned from. So they photoed everything and printed it out and put it in a hardbound cover and gave to all the grandkids to learn how to write correctly, because these days in school they don't teach you how to do that anymore. So that's an interesting story there, that Richard Petty would take the time to do that and still has an interest in how your signature looks.
And always has.
Probably the most signed signature in all of race.
One has to wonder how many times he has signed Richard Petty over the years.
I got a story, a Richard signature story. When we did the first Columbia Speedway Racers Reunion, we had plaques made for all of the people that helped. There was 120 people that volunteered their time to help put that event on total. So Tim Leeming and I went up to and met with Richard and did a nice interview with him. And I was just going to have Richard sign one of them, and then I was going to copy it over on all the others. And he says, no, sit down here. I sat there beside him while he signed all 120 of them individually, very graciously, and sat there. And we had a great conversation while he was doing that. And it was – and I you know, you've seen it a million times. Each one of them looked just like the last one.
Yep.
And he's a genuine person.
Absolutely.
Something about this whole signature deal, which many of you are aware of, Richard making this statement. Someone asked Richard one time, said, Richard, why do you wait after the race and sign everybody's autograph that's in line to get your autograph? And this was in the early 60s. When on the way to the car, they may very well drop it in the mud, lose it under the seat of the car, or dispose of it as trash. And he said, I would rather sit or stand and sign every autograph than have one person be denied and walk away and think that I was the biggest rear end that ever lived. He goes, that one person will tell 1,000 people how bad I was.
Exactly.
And that was his deal, is the personification of motorsports was by Richard Petty in finally bringing NASCAR into a marketing type of genre. You got to remember, everything's changed so much in motorsports, from the flat toe of the cars to the track and back. And it's amazing that the people that were not exposed to that, to see how difficult it was to get the car to the track. How would you like to flat toe anything from right here to Daytona?
It's hard to even imagine.
And a lot of people going to Daytona came from the Northeast.
That's
they flat toed. I remember coming out of church when I was a little kid seeing Axel Anderson or somebody coming right in front of us on Highway 17 in about 1957.
Well, there was no interstate.
Yeah.
Was a major run.
Yeah.
In 1965, Jack and I both went to Daytona, and I was going to Florence Darlington Tech. Yep. And on the way back to WATP in Marion after school one day, I was on Highway 301, which is the main artery from north to south. And just in front of the highway department was a little sandwich shop. And parked there was a 60 Ford with a pinkish top on it, white body, and had one of the old J.C. Whitney Sparkle Tone round headrest in it. And I looked at that car, and I go, wow, they're on their way to Daytona. I can't wait till Friday night. My brother and I are going to get in a 63 Plymouth, and we're going to head to Daytona, and we're going to meet Jack down there. Well, we got down there, and it's Saturday afternoon. The man that won the race was Curtis Turner. Second place was Donnie Allison in that white 64. That was a time that you really said, wow.
Oh, yeah.
I took Andy Belmont's car in 88, the little Pontiac that later Shauna Robinson won a race at Lawrenceville, Georgia at Lanier Raceway, and that car's in the Hall of Fame down at Talladega. It's the same car. It was rebodied right after we ran Daytona as a short track car. The interesting thing was, I'm taking that car down to Daytona. I come off of Highway 26 going towards Charleston on to 95, and man, it was a wonderful sight to see these guys out of the Northeast headed to Daytona, their cars all covered up and tied down on open trailers and pickup trucks with exterior muffler stacks by the cab, flannel shirts, smoking cigars, and you go, you know, wow, they're going to Daytona. And then you think yourself, man, I'm on my way to Daytona.
But, Bill, we've lost that. You know, we've talked about that on this show before. Now all the race cars are in trailers.
Nick Lucas says They don't promote anymore.
They don't.
You got to remember, in 1964, they're running basically the equivalent of a cup race out at Myrtle Beach Speedway. Major Melton's up here under a house in Cherry Grove working on his car, which was one of the former Buck Baker 62 yep. Chryslers.
Hey, but, Bill, Nick Lucas was not a bad promoter. He was actually pretty good.
Nick was really good.
He was a good
because
promoter.
Nick basically learned a lot from Hux, who used to promote Wendell Hux, who used to promote the old Conway racetrack. It's an interesting story how, and I'd hate to go into it, about how Nick acquired Myrtle Beach Speedway. Because it had been closed. Everybody keeps forgetting it closed after the 65 season.
Yep.
Yeah. And then it reopened in 68 when Nick got it.
Or 69. Conway was the – when Conway come online, that was pretty much
– Well, Buckshot Cagle and all of his heavy equipment created too many racetracks. You got to remember, here's Hemingway, cost you 99 cents to get in, racing Friday and Saturday night. The reason they charged you 99 cents was so they didn't pay the sales tax.
Yeah. Yep.
That was the
and
they price gave you a, at Conway.
They gave you
same
a penny
thing.
Back. But Buckshot goes out and cuts a track out of the woods in Dillon, cuts a track out of the woods in Marion, cuts a track out of the woods at Little River. I think he maybe did Leland, and he also cut
the devil down Leland.
He did, and he did Andrews. There was a
Black
track
River
in
Speedway.
There was a track south of Charleston
the
off 17.
Track.
Yep.
Sumter. I mean, all these tracks were built during the same
Twin City.
Twin Cities,
Twin
right.
City. God bless
First
them.
Time I ever saw the big propane jet heaters were under the grandstands.
Yeah, heating
and then they
atmosphere.
Had,
heated grandstand, man. That was
and
cool.
And they had plastic down the back side of it, so the heat would go through yep. the bleachers and oh, keep
that,
you warm.
That was the theory. Yeah. That was the theory.
Well, I had a,
it smelled
lady,
a little funny, though.
I had a lady call me the other day, and she goes, I understand you've been around racing a long time. I go, yeah, I have. She goes, didn't you manage Myrtle Beach? I said, yeah. She goes, I'm here visiting my dad, who was in the Air Force, and in 1957, he's got a stock certificate here. Oh, my gosh. I've heard that story before.
Ramby Raceway.
She goes, it says at mature value, because it was issued like a bond, it was supposed to be worth $28,000 now.
Wow. So where's my money? Bill?
Needless to say, I said, you've got a nice piece of wallpaper.
Yeah, I think there was 240 stockholders in Ramby Raceway.
Oh, yeah. And some interesting ones. We're doing a little piece for the race that's going to be on MAV Entertainment, and we did a piece with Jack Thompson, who used to be the photographer at the old Coastal Speedway in the early days of Ramby. And we remembered Dwight Lamb. I don't know if you know. Do y'all know who Dwight was? Jack, you would.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I don't know if everybody
Skips.
Else would.
Skips.
He owned Skips Kitchen in Myrtle Beach. Was also a
photography
shop.
In town.
Yep.
And
a record shop. I used to buy records.
Records, right?
Record album.
I bought a Ray Conniff album because of Swonderful on it, so I could use that little da 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 da. But the interesting thing is that Dwight was a racing guy, and he promoted along with Hardy, the original one, the old Coastal Speedway. And then he went out to Ramby, and everybody keeps forgetting it was called Ramby, Racing Association of Myrtle Beach, Inc.
Yep.
Nobody knew that
thought,
name.
I thought, it was unique.
It was.
It was called Ramby Raceway.
Had trees all around it when it first opened.
Hey, Bill.
You couldn't even see it.
Bill, remember the original Ramby? There was a big space between the grandstand
and
the front
stretch.
Tell us the reason for that.
The reason for that, you must remember, originally when everything got started in Myrtle Beach, it was at Washington Park.
Yep.
And that was located where Fuddruckers is in Myrtle Beach.
Behind Fuddruckers.
Behind Fuddruckers.
Across from the...
Yeah. Highway 17 on the front side, 21st Avenue on the other side, and then on the back side, it was the Oak Street.
Yes.
So Washington Park was a horse racing facility, but it was for trotters. And... That was an interesting place.
Was gambling legal at
Washington
Park?
That was what they always wanted to have, was gambling in Myrtle Beach for the horses.
Yep.
That would bring tourists to town.
And that started in the 40s, I believe.
But it was never in the 30s. It was never a gambling
track. I think they did at some point.
They tried.
Yeah.
But when Ramby was built, I've heard these are the reasons why it was configured in the original configuration. You must remember it had two entrances. the entrances that it has now and the entrance that now goes into Grand Strand Baptist Church. That property was that big.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So if you came from Conway, you went out the one on 501 towards Conway. If you came from Myrtle Beach, you went out the other one. But when they built the track, they built the half-mile dirt, and then the guardrail and everything, and the bleachers were moved back from the track.
Yeah, a long way.
That was to be able to have a horse race, which the very first race at Myrtle Beach Speedway was a horse race that preceded the automobiles. Yep. Second, here's the one that really was the thing. Daytona was being built in 1959 and open. Myrtle Beach was built in 1958. The irony of it, everything is, you go 4.5 miles out of Myrtle Beach, right-hand side, you build a half-mile dirt track. You go 4.5 miles out of Daytona at that time, and they built a 2.5-mile super speedway. Now, those guys had some vision. They also had difficulty getting financing for it. But getting back to Myrtle Beach, there was enough land there in 1958 to build a 1-mile super speedway, and that was another reason why the grandstands sat back from the front straightaway. Now, I can tell you how the dog leg got put in it.
I remember that.
The NDRA.
That was like in the 70s, about 75.
When Blythe Construction Company showed up to pave the track in 75, and that's when the Castle Dracula car was running and guys like that, Nick and I were out there, and Nick said, "I would like to have something unique here." And I said, "Why don't you put a dog leg on the front side?" And the guy from Blythe Construction said, "It won't really cost you that much more. And all I have to do is run the bulldozer over here, and we'll grade it out, and we'll pave it, and you'll have a dog leg on the front straightaway." That's how that came about.
Buckshot called it this newly rejuvenated Myrtle Beach Speedway.
Yes, sir.
Hello, everybody. Buckshot Cagle from Rose Hill District.
Rose Hill Section of Georgetown County with my big fat wife.
School District number 23.
Yeah, this newly rejuvenated Myrtle Beach Speedway.
Well, you know, this coming weekend, a little more history be added to Myrtle Beach with the Southeastern Limited Late Models, the Chargers, the Super Trucks, and the Mini Stocks. And, of course, next weekend we run the Myrtle Beach 400 with the Late Models and the Modifieds. And Timothy Peters was already out testing the track yesterday along with his two drivers, the same driver that won up at Martinsville several weeks ago. We're going to have a good field of cars.
How many cars do you expect for the late model?
I really think we'll have anywhere between 70 and 74.
Wow.
And as far as the limiteds, we'll be in excess of 50 with both classes there. I don't know what we'll do as far as modifieds, but we'll get a lot of extra drivers for the mini stocks this weekend because the rules are a little open for this one. One of the things about Myrtle Beach is it's unique in a lot of ways. But once again, it's kind of like the Air Force Base commander came to a Rotary Club back in 1990 and said, "People are encroaching on the approaches to the air base, and our mission is being jeopardized." And I said, "They're going to close the base." And that's what they did in 91. And likewise, you still have a lot of people who are moving into the area. They don't like the sound. They don't like the noise. They don't like this. They don't like that. But the deal is they drove by it every day before they went and bought a piece of property.
Exactly. They don't count anymore.
And the original deal of why it's there is because then Mayor Ramsey in Myrtle Beach said, "We got to move this thing out of town. We got to get it away from the few motels at that time were on Highway 17.
And it was way out of town.
It was out of town.
Well, there was only one thing other than that between here and Red Hill, and that was the old Baker Furniture, which is now the Mexican restaurant across from what used to be Fowler Motors. It was isolated. It was by itself. It was in a period of time when you had a two-lane road. There was no bypass around Conway. And when you got to Myrtle Beach, the first thing you did was you hoped they were going to have the Waterway Bridge open and you would get to see a boat go down the Intracoastal. And kids would jump out of their cars and run down there next to the waterway to see the boats go by. Because you knew you were at the beach.
Yep.
Just like Bowman Gray and Winston-Salem. And look, the town is now all around it.
Oh, yeah.
Remember they built a drag strip across the Myrtle Beach back in the mid-60s? Remember that? Didn't
they had the drag
long.
Strip on Forest Brook Road in the 60s.
Which is close to where you live.
There was one across from the racetrack, though, for just
that's
a brief period.
That's pretty close.
That's pretty close.
That's pretty close, but it wasn't exactly across.
A mile away, maybe?
Yeah.
But it was on that side of the
road. Oh, yeah, the other side.
Yeah. Matter of fact, the main two roads that lead into Forest Brook in the original subdivision are the two lanes that were the drag strip. You can drive all the way down to where the turnaround was.
Now, is that right where Fort Caroline was?
Nope. Fort Caroline sat there, on the corner of Forest Brook Road and Highway 501.
Okay. But a few minutes ago, we were kind of jumping around here. We were talking about race cars. You're talking about towing a race car, flat towing.
Mm-hmm.
It is amazing when W.C. Bell and Bobby and these guys take these vintage cars down to Daytona on open trailers, driving down Highway 95 and seeing people pull up beside the cars, taking pictures, waving. All that's gone.
Ask us where we're going.
Yeah, where are you going? I mean, today's racing, they're all in these covered trailers. You can't see anything. Kids don't get excited.
Yep.
You know, it just makes
a whole dimension that's been lost.
We create quite a spectacle when we're caravanning. We've got five or six trailers.
Yeah, exactly.
And all these old vintage cars that most of these people that, with their cell phones taking pictures have never seen before.
Exactly.
Well, you know, there are only a few really great racing museums in the country. And back when Dr. Art Jordan had the Winter Circle restaurant and he had the Baby Ruth car, and that was the real Baby Ruth car of Jeff Gordon.
Yeah, there was a Sam Ard car.
There was a Sam Ard car, but that was not Sam's car. It was a duplicate built at the same facility. We bought that car in a Quonset hut on a farm up in outside of Burlington, North Carolina. It was a duplicate. It was an Oldsmobile Apollo. The guy had put his love into this car, his heart into the car, and it happened to be built during the 1980 season. The car only ran two races, and that's when NASCAR, in their infinite wisdom, changed from the V8 engine to the V6, and the guy couldn't afford to put a motor in it, so it sat in that Quonset hut from 1980 until 1994. And Doc bought that car with a quick change rear-ended, in it, a Gene White fuel cell. Everything was there, less the motor. You couldn't duplicate it today for $3,000.
Do you know, where did that car wind up, Bill? Do you know? Because that restaurant didn't stay there very long.
All the cars, I'm the guy that negotiated selling them for Doc, and they all ended up in Daytona, Florida, with Squeak Kennedy, a guy that's driven a lot of ARCA races and also ran the 24 hours at Daytona, always in a pink car. But Squeak bought them all. The interesting story is the Baby Ruth car. Everybody used to call and go, is that the real car? And you go, yeah, that's the real car. The real car was built by Bill Davis. That car had a 2x3 chassis rail in it. Andy Belmont eventually ended up after Shauna Robinson and Rodney Combs had the Luxair sponsorship, and it had a roof flap put in it because it was after the 95 season. That automobile sat in his garage down here until Squeak got all the cars. And they had a tough time selling the car because, you know, it's, well, you know, is it the Baby Ruth car? Is it not? An old guy, and it wouldn't run. It would not turn over. So an old guy, he told me he was 68 years old. He said, I'm retired, but I've always wanted to own a race car. Never have had one, and I kind of liked Jeff Gordon, and so I bought it. He says he took it home. He got the motor running. He goes, he parked it at the North Turn in Daytona, and he said, you know, I didn't know what kind of response that we'd get. He didn't even paint it. It was left the way it was when Doc had it. He got a note on the car one night. It said, do not move this race car. Do not tow it away until we see you tomorrow at 11 o'clock. He called me. He goes, is this car stolen? I said, no, it's the real car. It's the real McCoy. He goes, somebody's coming to see it in the morning at 11 o'clock, and they've said I can't move it. So he goes at 11 the next morning, and a car pulls up. Guy gets out, walks over to the car, and he goes, you mind if I open the hood? No. He said, you mind if I look under the car? No. That's a real McCoy son. This old guy, he goes, he's got a 2x3 chassis rail in it. We were the only ones that had that in 91 under the Baby Ruth car. He said, I only had three of these cars. He said, four of them have been sold at Barrett Jackson, which means they never existed. But he goes, they claim that they've got the car. This is the real McCoy. He goes, let me sign it. So it was Bill Davis. Mm-hmm. He said, I'll be back tomorrow. I'm coming back tomorrow. And the guy says, it wasn't stolen. He goes, it's your car. The next day, another guy shows up, and my senior moment might affect me a little bit here, but the guy showed up with Bill, opened the hood. He opens the hood. He looks at the motor, and he turned to him. He goes, that motor run? He goes, yep, it sure does. He says, it wasn't running when I got it. He says, well, what'd you find wrong with it? He goes, one of the roller lifters had turned sideways and had broken, and it locked the motor up. He says, were you able to fix it? He went down to Ford dealer and got an SVO roller and put it in there and freed the motor up, and it cranked up and ran. And he goes, who are you? And the guy, and I can't think of his name right now, he goes, I'm the guy that built all the Ford SVO V6s. He said, you have only one of four that are running.
Wow.
So this guy said he and his wife like to ride around. They took it to Dawsonville, Georgia, and I think it's up at the museum in Charlotte. And he said, what we like to do is take along Baby Ruth little nuggets and give them out to kids and talk to people about racing. And that's what this thing's been all about since the beginning, is the fact that it creates a good communications system with a lot of people who enjoy the sport.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I don't want to dominate this deal, folks.
Oh, we are enjoying this very much.
We knew we couldn't slow you down anyway, so it doesn't make any difference.
Only problem is you guys want to put a restrictor plate on me.
No.
Was that Terry Ellidge?
No.
Bill?
No.
Was it Terry Ellidge?
No. Wow. I know his name, and the time I drive away from here tonight, I'll be able to think of it. But it's like if something happened when I turned 70 years old. It's like, what did we do yesterday?
Exactly.
Yes.
I know all about that.
Wow. Is that the car that holds the record at Myrtle Beach?
It held the record. It was the fastest qualifier in 91 in the whole bit. Then Elliot Sadler held the record at Myrtle Beach. You got to remember that we also got some new pavement in 91. And then they changed the engine rules from the V6s back to the V8s. And Elliot Sadler won the race. And that was a year we had something kind of unique. And go back to Nick, being a good promoter he was. He says, Bill, we need to have some type of unique trophy. And I go, well, what do you want to do? He says, I thought something with a seashell or something on it would be nice because it's like Myrtle Beach. So I go down to one of the local shell shops and pick out all these good-looking shells and take them to the trophy shop, and they made us a nice-looking trophy that was representative of Myrtle Beach. So Elliot wins the race. I go down to the trophy shop, and the girl there says, you know how many of those trophies I've made? And I said, how many? She says, I made 8 of those for him to give out to different sponsors and people and to go in his house and the car owner's house. And I told Nick that story, and Nick said, I told you that would be a good idea.
Hey, let's go back to a point you made earlier, Bill, that in 1958-59, Myrtle Beach was being constructed, or Ramby was being constructed, as was Daytona. The two cities at that time, Myrtle Beach as a city versus Daytona Beach as a were probably on par with each other as tourist destinations, et cetera, et cetera. My point is, if the thought process had gone a little bit different, Myrtle Beach could have probably handled a super speedway perhaps easier than Daytona could.
Probably,
in 1958.
Probably so, but I think it's much like this, and I know a lot of people think that Bill France built Daytona single-handedly. That's not true. He had trouble getting financing from a lot of different sources. And the guy that owned, I want to think it was Meekum, but it's not Meekum. The guy that owned Murchison, who owned Union Oil, which was Pure at the time, landed in Daytona on his way out to the islands. And something was wrong with his airplane. So he's sitting at the airport, and Bill France Sr. had a plane. And he said, why don't you just borrow my plane and go on your trip and come back by and see me when you bring the plane back? That was the beginning of Pure putting some money into building the Super Speedway. The other one that I like to tell, and I heard, why was Pepsi Cola the soft drink that you got in Daytona from the day it was built up until the second and third generation came along.
Bobby's raising his hand.
I know that.
Because Pepsi and the local bottler went to Purchase New York and said they had a finance division and got the financing to help build the track. And as long as Bill France Sr. was alive, it was a Pepsi track. As a matter of fact, such things at Daytona, when Jack and I went down, the first canned drink that I had from Pepsi, if you'll recall, Jack, you remember they had the light blue cans that looked like they had ice cubes all the way around them in 1965, and that was the first canned soft drink. Holly Farms was involved, same year, Jack. Under the scoreboard, they had this big tent. But they had all this charcoal cooking in there, and they were selling quarters of Holly Farms at the concession stands of chicken. And it was, like, delicious. It smelled great and the whole bit. Now, remember Freddie Agabashian at the end of the 65 race? Cale Yarborough, I think, ran second, and Lorenzen won. It was a rain-shortened race, and Agabashian was a former IndyCar driver that worked for Champion Spark Plug Company. And on the broadcast, he goes, "This young driver, Cale Yarborough, he's a force to be reckoned with in the future. This guy's got some potential running with the golden boy, Fred Lorenzen."
Bill France went to Coca-Cola in the construction phase and tried to get anything. They flatly turned him down, and Pepsi gave him like $6,000, and he immediately put it into the grandstands. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, Coca-Cola was on their ear on the outside.
Well, I'm going to change the subject. When you talk about Daytona a little bit, Bill France was a very foresighted guy. But every time that I've been down there to race, either in the Dash Series, and I got to ride around down there 11 times, I still race a sports car, and I've run a lot of races down there in the IMSA RS Series and in SCCA. I always tell whoever's an employee that I think might go back to the France family and tell them one thing. And that is, thank you for giving me the opportunity to run at the World Center of Racing.
Well, since you said that, let me ask you a question.
Clint,
in this current environment, if you were going to build a racetrack tomorrow, a super speedway of some magnitude, what size would it be? Would it be a mile? Would it be three quarters? Or would it be 3 miles? Is bigger better now, or is smaller better?
People go to the racetrack to see what they can't see anyplace else. It's like the X Games. It's like motocross. Daytona and Talladega are still the ones in which, hey, we go there because the unexpected can happen. And Lady Luck will smile on someone. I've been in two races at Daytona that took the lives of two individuals. I sat next to one at the driver's meeting. And I don't mind telling you, I cried for five laps under yellow because they didn't stop the race in the whole bit. But I will tell you what the difference is, and this may sound asinine. When they dropped that green flag and we went back to racing, everybody was back on the throttle. And my disappointment was I got up to fourth place, four of us in the lead lap. It's now lap 69. We're less than 11 laps to go. And the back glass blew out of the car on a restart. And I took a long slide around and around. I ended up 10th. And I came back the next year and I ran 5th in a short track car, which everybody said, you can't, this car will never be competitive. And it wasn't competitive, but I got to ride around. I got to be at Daytona. And a lot of people can sit around and dream about
that. What
made
it competitive? Was that the draft?
The draft, and we also did something else that you can't do today. We laid the rear spoiler down. Jesse Causey from over at Conway was with me. We laid the spoiler down to where it was almost flat out, and Andy Belmont, whose car it was, said, "You won't be able to hang on to this." And I said, "Well, you've got to use some judgment." And the two judgments that you have to use is, one, if you're going too fast, you can back out of the throttle. And if you really get scared of this thing, you can tow the brake and bring it to the pits. That's what you did. But let me tell you, racing at Daytona is like flying a little airplane. It's exactly like that. Mm-hmm. And you can feel the wind, and everything's right there. But the little thing that I will tell you, Jack, because you were involved in me first going down to Atlanta, The Formula V taught me more about the draft than anything I've driven.
Yep.
And once you get in the draft down there, the race will come to you if you don't do something stupid.
Cool. Well, we're going to give Tim a segment tonight.
Tim, you still there, buddy?
Yeah, I'm still here. I really don't need a segment, but I do want to say a couple of things. I think we all need to send our heartfelt sympathy out to Bill and Sheila Blair, who lost their 17-year-old grandson last night. And they're really, as you would expect, very distraught about that. And the other thing, Jeff, looking at the calendar that I've got here before me, aren't you going to be out and about and gone for something? What is the schedule for shows?
We're doing a show next week, then we'll miss two. We'll be back December 5th after that. After next week. I'll be gone to Malaysia for 2 weeks.
Okay, thank you.
I'll just try.
I've covered a golf tournament.
Malaysia County Speedway.
Yeah, it's a dirt track.
Yeah, got a lot of green there.
Sand track.
Just wanted to
volcanic
acknowledge Bill and Sheila's loss because that has to be something that's
terrible.
Incredibly hard.
Yeah.
You know, but thanks for that, and thanks for giving me the schedule on what's going. Next week we're here. 2 weeks after that we're not.
Right.
Okay. I think I got it. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome, man. So we got 14 minutes left, Bill.
You know, Bill.
Where's that stopping now?
where the Grand Strand Baptist Church is now used to be the Gator Hole. Remember that?
Well, the Gator Hole was basically out of turn three. It was more like into turn three because when Richard ran off down the back straightaway and he flipped over into the Gator Hole, and then they had to come tow him out.
And then Russell Blackman wound up in the Gator Hole.
And Russell, that was his last race of Labor Day weekend of 1961 and became a paraplegic, I understand.
Now, I don't know if I've asked you about this, Bill, or not, but he had been in Darlington. Well, he was expected to be at Darlington for the Southern 500. Had he qualified for the Southern 500?
Not to my knowledge, because I went to the 61 race. You got to remember something else that happened in either 61 or 62 was the Paul McDuffie crash on the back straightaway with Bobby Johns, and we were talking about Bobby a little earlier, and I got to announce some races with Bobby Johns with the original Universal Racing Network and Hank Schofield, Southern Motor Racing News. But I don't recall that. We haven't had that many drivers from this area.
Well, there was a newspaper article.
Southern 500.
There was a newspaper article about his getting hurt at Ramby, and it basically implied that he was going to be in the Southern 500.
But I don't remember his name in the starting lineup on the insert in the program.
I know.
And that is the final deal because that was never printed until around midnight of Saturday night at a local printer over there. I think you got to kind of take a look at things. Danny Smith from out at Sacristy, he had the opportunity to drive a car at Darlington, went over and tested. And then I won't say whose car it was, but he said, hey, I just didn't feel comfortable in that particular car, which is oftentimes smart. You get hurt in cars that you're not familiar with.
I know whose car it was.
Hovey Marcello was one of the last guys to drive at Indianapolis. The reason he died was because he wasn't in his own car. He drove somebody else's car, and they were working on the containment-type headrest at that time. And the one he drove was wider than what his helmet was, so it flopped his head around, and once again, that's what injured him, and that's what took him away. It's crazy stuff. It's like the Hans device. Everybody fought the thing. It's hard to get in and out of the car with a Hans device on. Especially, you know, if you've got a fairly small window opening. Do y'all want to talk for two more hours or what we want to do?
Well, we used to do this show for 2 hours.
But it's impossible to get out if you're dead.
Yeah,
you can't do that.
I think that, you know, a lot of the safety things in NASCAR, but that element of danger sometimes seems to be going away. And I think that's an element that you still need because it's like this. You want to see the guy go to the moon, but you want to be watching should something happen.
Yeah. What now for the MAV presentation coming up? I know you've been doing some interviews. I saw an interview you did with Lee Pulliam.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that he would come out and make some statements about climbing the ladder, how hard that is.
Well, here's a four-time champion. Guy can wheel a race car. He's as smart as anyone I have seen.
National champion.
National champion. But where is he going?
There's nowhere
where
to go.
Where is he going? There's he could go if he had... I used to read a book called Stalking the Motorsport Sponsor. You need a patron. You need a patron who brings the financing there, and that is your sponsor to get you to the next level. And without that patron, if you don't have a lot of personal financing, you can't sit in the seat long enough to get there. But I've seen some guys who used to have the opportunity that lasted 2 to 3 or 4 races. They were there, they were good, but Lady Luck never smiled on them.
Yep.
And Lady Luck must smile on you if you expect to win.
Amen.
Yep.
You have to be good and lucky.
Well, I think that's the whole point about it. But let's go back to some early days at Darlington. You know, you take a look at Darlington when it was really in its heyday. It started all the cars.
Oh, yes.
Everybody was there. You had a flatter track. Cale Yarborough says to this day he would rather have his first win at Darlington on the old track, not the new track. He says it's changed 3 times since he won that first one. But Cale, being a local boy and had that pride, and I was there in 57 when Bobby Myers got killed, and I have an interesting story about that. You might enjoy it, you may not.
Go for it.
57, my dad was head of the rescue squad in the rural fire department in Marion, and we rode the fire truck over, and we went to the fire department, and then we went to the racetrack. My brother and a cousin, and my dad said, I don't know where you're going to sit. You can't stay inside the racetrack. So he pulled up to the fence along the pits and put me over the fence along with my brothers and our fried chicken and our pimento cheese sandwiches. And there was a red Dodge pickup truck there, and it had a home-built cooler on the back that was made with slat-type siding like you used to see in old houses, but it had galvanization in the center. But it was heavy enough that you could stand on it. So we're sitting with this lady and her 3 kids. Race starts. Everything's going along fine. And I'm yelling for my favorite driver of all time, the millionaire timberman out of Roanoke, Virginia, Curtis Turner. Oh, man. Curtis was doing okay. He was driving one of those smoky cars. Paul Goldsmith was in the other, but along about lap 27, the big cloud of smoke along the back straightaway and the whole bit, and the race was red flagged. The lady got off the truck. She left with some other ladies. She came back about 15 minutes later. They started the race, and I'm still yelling for Curtis. And my brother comes to me, and he goes, you got to stop yelling for Curtis. You got to tone it down. And I go, I like Curtis. He goes, you better tone it down. We're sitting with Cotton Owens' wife. Well, she overheard that. She came over to me, and she said this. She goes, son, you yell for anybody you want to, and you have a good time at this racetrack. She goes, that's what they are here for. They want to hear you yell for them and the whole bit. But I said, your husband's in a 6 car. And she goes, I know, I know. She goes, but it'll be okay, but you yell for who you want to. Well, now my man Curtis gets involved in a crash, and Smokey's trying to change his radiator, and I got to change allegiance. So I pull for Cotton. Cotton is the leader of the race, and we're down to about 20 to go. And he comes down to pit lane, and that's before we had the wall separating the pits. And he had to get some fuel, and he goes back out, and he's second, and the checkered flag flew for Speedy Thompson.
Number 46.
Yep. And the irony of that is you talk about open trailer cars. I lived in Marion. I rode around Liberty Street one afternoon, and there was Paul McDuffie with his checkered flag type of cap on, and there's the car. And the next Saturday, he wins. I mean, next Monday, he won at Darlington. I just think those are type of experiences I don't think that you can see today. Now you go see the M&M's carts and a pristine deal, yep. No wheel marks on it. It's absolutely perfect, and the chances are it never was a race car.
Yep.
But, you know, I think that the other deal is, and I'll say this, I think all the race cars are too drab today. The M&M's car sticks out there. Jeff Gordon's car stuck out there. But right now, I don't know who the graphics guys are, but they're not doing a very good job.
They look just like the cars on the highway. They all look alike.
Yep, that's true. The fact that nobody, but nobody, is putting enough lettering on their car for you to identify it, even on TV, on a close shot. You can't read who the sponsor is.
You can't. On some of them, you can't even tell what the car number is. It kind of blends with the background.
Well, I've always thought that with so many sponsors for a driver today, you lose some identity.
Yep.
You don't look immediately at the track and say, damn, that's Jeff Gordon. You like,
exactly.
Who is that?
Who is that?
Oh, that's Kyle Busch or something.
Yep. Yeah.
Who was the 24 car originally?
Cecil Gordon.
From Horseshoe, North Carolina. Yes. 24, Cecil Gordon. Yeah. By the way, and I have to tell this story, I loved Ray Melton.
We do too. We love Ray Melton.
Ladies and gentlemen, move back away from that fence down there. Move back away. That's a dangerous area at the famed Darlington Raceway. Ladies and gentlemen, we're getting ready to run the LF Dash. Four laps around the racetrack here, the final race of the day. Sitting on the pole, Bobby Musgrover.
Who? But these guys ran the LF Dash. But he was always kind to me and everything. And he was really a Carney type announcer. Announced all the thrill shows, and he was from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Yeah, Virginia Beach.
Ray liked to tell the little story about they shot a movie about stock car racing, and they premiered it up in Charlotte. And Big Bill France was going to do "Gentlemen, Start Your Engines," and Ray was sitting behind Big Bill in the theater. So Big Bill comes up there, and they go, "Bill France, chairman of NASCAR." But come, his voice was changed. It was Ray doing, "Gentlemen, start your engines!" The other deal he used to say was, "When you introduce me, you don't say my name, don't say gentlemen, don't say ladies. What do you want me to do, Ray? All I want you to do is, and now for the most dramatic moment in all professional sports, Ray Melton." And he did the command, and it was like, you know, nobody did it better.
Yeah, from the metropolitan cities and country hamlet towns.
He's up in the championship groove here at the famed Darlington Raceway, running high, wide, and Hampson, moving up the second quarter down the back straightaway. Little Bud Moore from Charleston, South Carolina, sponsored by the Piggy Park and Maurice Messenger. I asked Petty, I said, "Richard, do you remember your Ray's sponsorship?" "Ray's?" "Yeah." I said, "They used to have one of those burger joints right on the corner of 8th Avenue and Highway 17 in Myrtle Beach." "Yeah." And I said, "What about Southern Motors? High Point, North Carolina."
"Yep."
If you go back, you're talking about marketing. Why does that remain in my head that I should know these guys?
Lafayette Ford.
Ford forever.
East Tennessee Motor Company. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Lafayette for a while.
They're still there. They're still there.
They're not owned by the same people, but that was George Purvis.
Purvis.
And he had a son named Patrick. I got to be a buddies with him. And his other son, George Jr., ran Lafayette Ford, but Patrick ran Patrick Ford. There were two Ford dealerships owned by the same people. But they were instrumental in that Lafayette Ford deal. And Ford at that time was looking for people to be the sponsors on the cars. And take a look at Hallman Moody. We're going to change the subject for just a second. Where were all the GT40 Fords built that won at Le Mans for Ford Motor Company? You know, they were all built in Charlotte, North Carolina, by Hallman Moody with the 427 engines. And why were they GT40 Fords? They were 40 inches high. Seriously.
Yeah, there had to be a reason for
it. With the exception of one. And that was the car Dan Gurney drove. And if you ever see it, you'll notice there's a bubble over where his helmet would be because he was too tall.
The home of the Gurney Burger. There used to be one in Johnson City, Tennessee.
Really?
Yeah. Guys, that's Bill. You got to promise to come back, man.
Well, I'll be glad to do that, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say, hey, look, come out and support Myrtle Beach Speedway.
Absolutely.
You got to do it because it's like this. These are your memories for the future. They were my memories over the years, and I've had a lot of good times at the racetracks. I got to run Performance Racing Network for 10 years. I got to work for Humpy Wheeler. I met a lot of people along the way, and it's amazing how many memories I have and how I can relive them, but no matter who you are, everybody thinks they can drive a race car. I don't care who you are. The problem is today, nobody's teaching you how to drive a four-speed in any driver's education class.
That's true. That's true. Folks, it's been real. Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Matt. Thanks to all you guys. Thanks for you folks hanging around and listening to us. We appreciate that. As always, we'd like to say a very special thanks to the men and women who serve in our military. Thank you for doing that so that we can do this. Each and every one of you, good night and God bless.
Broadcasting live from the CRN studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is...